So welcome to our Smith Pettit opening lecture. Tonight we will be hearing from a scholar taking a look at the interplay between Mormonism and Catholicism. So we're hoping to hear some new ideas and framing ideas about Mormonism in a new way. I will turn the time over to Dan to introduce our speaker tonight.
It's a pleasure to introduce not only a great scholar, but I think we'll really learn a lot from a great person. But he's become a good friend over the years. Early on in my tenure at Sunstone, he contacted me. He's been engaged with Mormonism for quite a while from his position at the College of Holy Cross. He teaches there in Roman Catholicism, of course, which is what the school is based upon, but modern religious movements, Hinduism, and he'll have to maybe remind us of where he got his first interest in Mormonism. But he's been a thoughtful commentator and an engager with us. He writes op-eds. He's done wonderful things to really advance the kind of conversations that this year's theme is doing. So I was pleased to recommend him as the Smith Pettit lecturer this year. He actually had me back to speak on Mormonism, and I got to see him in the classroom situation at Holy Cross, and it was a great experience. But you'll know him from some past Sunstone issues, perhaps. One of the things that we were kind of saying was very cool is some of his students actually published in Sunstone. So we were their first publication, for a few of them sharing some of their thoughts. And he was telling me at lunch today, oh, by the way, we had to give him the cultural experience today. So we did Chuck-O-Rama for lunch. He didn't maybe explore as much as I thought he would there. We did Gilgal
Gardens. 3 months were enough.
We took him by the Madonna tree on 7th South, and it's so deteriorated now. I hope did you look it up online after you got that photo?
I was prepared.
Yeah, because I really was moved 6 or 7 years ago when I first saw it. It was pretty neat. So we did that, and then we went to the Church History Museum today too. So we've had a fun day of Matt reimmersing himself in our great tradition. But you know, you guys can all read his credentials here. Again, his bachelor's and master's. He went to Amherst College for his bachelor's. He did his master's and his PhD at the University of Chicago. He's been at the College of Holy Cross in Worcester, Mass. For quite a few years. He just got done with 6 years as the Dean of Honors, so he's excited to get back to his research and his scholarship. He's a scholar of Hinduism as well as other things. So have a great time. Ask him lots of questions. This is going to be fantastic. Max Bonds, welcome.
Thank you. Well, I'm extraordinarily grateful to be with all of you here this evening. Although I haven't been able to attend the Sunstone Symposium for the last few years, Sunstone has been an important part of my intellectual and spiritual life. At Sunstone, I've been welcomed, challenged, and reinvigorated. And I particularly appreciate the friendship that so many of you have shown me as I've tried, often hesitant and uncertain ways, to understand the Latter-day Saint tradition, both on its own terms and also how it relates to my own commitment to the Roman Catholic. So such is the subject of my talk this evening, the spiritual bridges and intellectual byways that speak to connections between Mormonism and Catholicism. And so I'd like to begin with Scripture. From 1 Nephi. And I said unto him, I know that he loveth his children. Nevertheless, I do not know the meaning of all things. Nephi's response to the angel after seeing the vision bequeathed to him being asked about the condescension of God is one of humility. He realizes the full import of what he has seen is veiled from him, that his own human understanding has limitations, and that the fullness of what he has seen has yet to be revealed. Needless to say, I am not Nephi. I'm afraid I might appear to be more of a Zoramite descending upon the Ramiumpton. But I do think Nephi stands in for all of us, especially when we behold something new, something unexpected. We do not know the meaning of all things, obviously, but we do, and even we must, reflect upon what we behold to ask questions, engage in dialogue, as Nephi did with the angel, and as Sunstone has continued to do over all these years. So I offer my reflections to you all this evening in the spirit of humility. And in speaking about the intersections between Mormonism and Roman Catholicism, I know many of you have also thought about these connections, whether you're Mormon or Catholic or spiritual seeker. So I invite you all to participate and offer your own perspectives during the question and answer session afterwards. So I'd like to begin by sharing an experience with you that I had during my first visit to Salt Lake City, where I visited the Museum of Church History. As a Roman Catholic and historian of religion, I've always been interested in material elements of Mormon culture, things that I could touch, and things that perhaps might touch me. My first memory of the museum was seeing a lock of Brigham Young's hair. And when I looked at it, I said to myself, this I understand. It seemed familiar to me, like a relic, which is so much part of the Catholic tradition as I've known it. What surprised me, however, was that the lock of Brigham Young's hair was not really set aside in any special way, except in the display case. And though there was an identifying plaque, it wasn't with a lot of other stuff that you would find, perhaps, if it were in Catholicism. It wasn't in a gold and silver holder, for example. It was in a frame. There was not an obvious place for people to pray in its presence. And most interestingly, there did not seem to be added security, as one might expect for an equivalent Catholic relic. So the lock of Brigham Young's hair didn't seem to be in danger of being stolen, and which struck me as being quite interesting. I then went to another room, and I saw a quite arresting painting entitled The Tree of Life, Lehi's Dream. Now, at that point, I didn't know the specific scripture the painting referred to. I looked at the painting and examined the composition. I first looked at the building, which seems to be an interesting combination of Asian architectural style, and, of course, the tree, along with an evidently Japanese couple. But the composition of the painting drew me to the child at the center, to her almost radiant or blinding whiteness. And I could also see in the picture as a whole evidence of fairly sophisticated artistic training, particularly how shapes mirrored each other throughout the painting. So, for example, if you see Lehi in the corner, he's mirrored by the man over to our right. The Asianness of the tree is mirrored by the Asianness of the building, and so forth. And there are also interesting uses of color, the use of yellow and green hue throughout, and of course the progression from dark on our right to light on our left. And the mountains in the background, I don't know if they come out very well in this projection, have an almost archetypical status. So as I was looking at the picture, inspecting it really, I noticed a middle-aged woman standing next to me. And she was cradling her head in her hands as she looked at the picture. And I could see tears welling up in her eyes. And so I thought, what am I missing? What was it that I failed to understand? Why did this picture not move me as the way in which the lock of Brigham Young's hair did? So, I returned to Holy Cross, my home institution in Worcester, Massachusetts, and first found the scripture. I'm sure all of you know it, the famous vision of the rod of iron from the first book of Nephi. And so in the painting, you can see Lehi dreaming the tree of life with its white fruit. The rod of iron is visible in the background, and so is the river, in which, if you look closely, people are drowning. And of course, there's the great and spacious building, and there are people gathered on the parapet of the, or the veranda of the great and spacious building. Can't really see it here, but they're mocking the saints. So sometime later then, at my home institution, I met with a colleague in art history, and I wanted to explore with her what I had missed, to find some deeper way to appreciate the picture. And so I sat with her as we looked at the painting. And she decried it as a particularly and ostentatiously artless painting. It was unself-reflective, she said. It was all narrative. That is, it's just telling a simplistic story. It wasn't art. And at this point, it's important to mention the work of a good friend of Sunstone, Colleen McDaniel at the University of Utah, because she discusses these very issues in her magisterial work on material Christianity, especially where she discusses kitsch, or what is perceived as kitsch. And so I'll return to this painting at the conclusion of my talk. But what I will say is that this exchange prompted me to go in a different direction, to reflect on upon how Mormonism and Catholicism could substantively engage each other intellectually and thus begin to access each other's religious experience. But in doing so, I've encountered a number of obstacles which I'd like to share with you first, which brings us to the second part of my talk, A Bridge Too Far. And again, I'd like to begin with scripture.
Notice he has his own triple.
And the angel said to me, "Behold, the formation of a church which is most abominable of above all other churches. which slayeth the saints of God, and yea, and tortureth them, and bindeth them down, and yoketh them with a yoke of iron, and bringeth them down into captivity. And it came to pass that I beheld this great and abominable church, and I saw the devil that was the founder of it. And I also saw gold and silver and silks and scarlets and fine twined linen and all manner of precious clothing. And I saw many harlots. We'll get back to that. Nephi's vision here speaks of the great apostasy, at least as I understand it. The apostasy that led, following the principle of opposition, perhaps, to the restoration of the gospel through the revelations to Joseph Smith and the translation of the Book of Mormon. The idea of the Catholic Church, as well as other Christian denominations, being apostate is stated quite clearly in older compendia of Mormon beliefs, such as Bruce McConkie's Mammoth Mormon Doctrine. Apostasy, heresy, deviation are, of course, part and parcel of traditionalist pre-Vatican II Catholic views of most Protestant denominations. And it has to be said, with regard to Mormonism in particular, most Catholics, at least in my experience, and I'll be talking about this for the next couple of minutes, most Catholics would consider Latter-day Saints perhaps not really within the fold of Christianity, and would in any case be uninterested in the various nuances that could be used to describe the LDS tradition, such as non-Nicene or pre-Nicene Christian. And so, and indeed, in my own personal experience suggests that in many ways, substantive religious and intellectual and spiritual interchange between Catholics and Mormons is a bridge too far. Unlike many scholars who study Mormonism, I was not trained as a historian of America or American religions. I was trained as a South Asianist, and my specialty is Catholicism in India, of all places. So I didn't have any personal connections with Mormons as friends and neighbors. I grew up in a Catholic family in Massachusetts, far from the LDS heartland, and also not near Mormon communities in New England or in my home state of Massachusetts. So I'd have to say that my interest in Mormonism was intellectual. I did not feel a personal connection to the tradition when I first started out. I did do a lot of reading, however, not just the standard works by scholars such as Dan Shipps, Richard Bushman, and Terrell Gibbons. I also read Strangers in Paradox by Margaret and Paul Toscano. I also read wonderful Mormon novels such as Chris Bigelow's Kindred Spirits and Brother Brigham by D. Michael Martindale, which my students just love. And so what I found was that Mormonism was not only a religion, but a culture that was diverse and very much alive. And so I started teaching about Mormonism and writing about it initially for a Catholic magazine which, for the purposes of propriety, will remain nameless. This was during Mitt Romney's first campaign for president in 2008, and I took the opportunity to quote-unquote introduce Mormons and Mormonism to this magazine's readership. And so I used the Sunstone Symposium as a touchstone for talking about the diversity of Mormonism. And I received a lot of generous and exceedingly insightful advice and reviews from Dan Witherspoon. He remembers this very, very well. He was very generous with his time. This magazine, which again propriety prevents me from naming, kept sending versions back to me with demands for corrections on how I had distorted the LDS tradition, particularly not by identifying liberals and progressives at Sunstone, that is all of you, as outliers, not outliers in an otherwise conformist religious group. And editors also made what they claimed were clarifications, namely that the Lamanites were the Mormons, something that obviously confuses some basic elements of the LDS tradition. So I navigated this as best I could, and the article was published, though I was not exactly very happy with it. My aim was to present Mormonism as a religion, as something living, growing, and sometimes contentious, but with rich intellectual content. But the most revealing moment came when the magazine asked me to comment on a letter sent by a reader. The letter referred to Nephi's vision from the Book of Mormon, which I quoted at the outset, the great and abominable church being none other than the Catholic Church. In the view of this letter, Mormons were not only anti-Catholic to the core, but Mormons needed to repudiate this particular section of their sacred text. But the bulk of the letter was filled with Mormon stereotypes. Mormons are good bakers. They like jello and so on. You know, all this smally Mormon stuff, okay? And so I was happy to respond to the letter because it seemed to prove the very point I was trying to make, that conventional stereotypes about Mormons and Mormonism often prevent us from understanding the depth and diversity of the LDS tradition. When the letter and my response were published, a curious thing happened. The anti-Mormon comments were excised from the letter, as were my responses to them. While my take on the letter was to show it as being ignorantly anti-Mormon, the way it came out was defending Mormonism against the charge of being anti-Catholic, since I've certainly not seen any contemporary Mormon exegesis that links the Catholic Church with this great and abominable church in the vision. What I think was going on was that the editors of this magazine did not really see the point, that anti-Mormon stereotypes were just that, stereotypes. If someone had written an equivalent caricature of Catholics as being homophobic, sexist, authoritarian, for example, surely the editors of the magazine would have seen that. I figured that I'd have a little more luck writing for Mormon publications, as a Catholic sincerely interested in and respectful, at least I hoped I was, of the LDS tradition. And of course, Sunstone has provided that forum, and I really, you know, want to express my heartfelt gratitude for that. But I also tried to name a piece to an LDS church-affiliated newspaper, which, for the purposes of propriety, and I submitted a piece to this newspaper upon the death of President Gordon Hinckley. President Hinckley had made some very complimentary comments about John Paul II, and it seemed like an appropriate time for a Catholic to express appreciation for the witness of an important LDS leader. So what was strange was that in spite of 10 phone calls over a two-week period by the head of my college's Office of Public Relations, we heard no response. Now, being rejected by a newspaper is certainly nothing new to me. A lot of my writing is bad and should be rejected. So I'm not alleging any kind of conspiracy. But I have found in my experience that news organizations like to keep contact with institutions that might serve them in the future. So if they're going to reject something, they usually respond to phone calls, not out of courtesy as much as because they might want to establish a source for the future. In this case, it seemed clear that there was no interest from the side of this Mormon newspaper in building any kind of relationship with a Catholic institution, probably because there seemed to be no reason to. After all, what could Catholics possibly contribute to an LDS periodical? So in sum, I found on the Catholic side a preponderance of stereotypes that are still maintained when it comes to considering the life and culture of Latter-day Saints. And I've also found among many Catholics, at least those who are church leaders or public intellectuals, a tendency to dismiss Mormonism as being devoid of intellectual content. But an important counterexample to this, I think it's important to mention, can be found in the recent talk of the Orem Institute of Religion by the Catholic Bishop of Salt Lake that approached Mormonism seriously and sympathetically. From the LDS side, I can certainly say that I have been shown far more hospitality by Latter-day Saints than I know many Latter-day Saints have been shown by Catholics. Nonetheless, I do get a sense that in official church circles, there is perhaps not a great willingness for substantive engagement with Catholicism, or when the opportunity presents itself, there's a tendency to perhaps be rather flummoxed and unsure about what to do. So that brings us to the third section of my talk. And again, I'd like to introduce my reflections of Scripture. From Mosiah 4:27. And see that all these things are done in wisdom and order. For it is not requisite that a man should run faster than he has strength. And again, it is expedient that he should be diligent, that thereby he might win the prize. Therefore, all things must be done in order. When King Benjamin spoke about atonement and the remission of sins, he encouraged all his subjects to feed the hungry and clothe the naked and visit the sick. The good order of which King Benjamin speaks, at least as I understand it, is about the proper ordering of values and obligations as believers in God. We should act not only with diligence, but also with prudence. We do not need to have or do everything all at once. Likewise, we should only do those things for which we are ready. My contention here, at least based upon my experience, is that Catholics and Mormons aren't quite ready for a theological dialogue. To use King Benjamin's words, that may indeed be the prize or a prize, but obtaining it will be the result of diligent effort, not by running headlong into matters that might exceed our strength at the present time. It may well be that Catholics and Mormons may need to travel together along an intellectual byway, and I would contend that the academic study of religion can and does offer a particularly interesting intellectual byway, which has space for both Mormon and Catholic fellow travelers, if you will, who wish to understand each other and themselves in a different and perhaps revealing way. Within the United States, there's a continuum of approaches to the study of religion. Theology lies at one end of the spectrum, the study of religion within the explicit framework of a single religious tradition. And within this, you find a variety of subdivisions, and I'm sure you're all aware of this: ethics, systematic theology, ecclesiology, and so forth. So to look at Mormonism from a Catholic perspective, or to look at Catholicism from a Mormon perspective, would be a form of theology. On the other end of the spectrum is religious studies, or more specifically, the history of religion, which seeks to understand religion as a phenomenon. Within this, there can be a variety of approaches that draw quite liberally from anthropology, sociology, literary theory, and psychology. But the point is to look at religion without normative theological assumptions. Oftentimes, as well, the question of truth is bracketed out. Although some practitioners of religious studies will argue that religion is a human creation, the question of whether or not a particular religion is true is not considered to be an interesting or relevant issue or question as it would in some forms of theologizing. Also, since religion is a phenomenon, an object that can be studied, one can compare religious forms across not only religious traditions, but also in some cases across time and space. So it's my contention that this comparative aspect of religious studies, comparative religions in other words, offers a useful byway for both Catholics and Mormons to begin to engage each other in a way that circumvents some of the theological and in some cases prejudicial assumptions that often manifest themselves when the LDS and Catholic traditions are placed together side by side. So what I'd like to do is to give you some examples of how that comparison can be done, to present some intellectual byways, if you will, that open up perhaps new avenues of appreciation of both similarity and difference. So my framework is drawn from a seminal article by one of my teachers at the University of Chicago, Jonathan Z. Smith, in his piece, Adi Parvum Parvo Magnus Acerbus Erit, which means add a little to a little and there'll be a great heap. It's a line from the Latin poet Ovid. In this article, he surveys a variety of methods that have been used to compare religions. And though he's right in 1973, this framework is still very much valid and always an important touchstone in discussions of comparative approaches in the academic study of religion. So Smith identifies four basic approaches to the comparative study of religion, that is, to putting religions together side by side and trying to talk about them. The first is the ethnographic, the second is the encyclopedic, the third is the morphological, and the final one is the evolutionary. And so I'll discuss three of these, the ethnographic, the encyclopedic, and the morphological, but drop the evolutionary since it's an approach I'm not really that comfortable with. But I'll add another, however, the genealogical. And I ask for your patience here since I'll try to make things accessible and intellectually substantive without going overboard with all the professor's stuff. So let's begin. The ethnographic. Ethnography is something that's usually associated with anthropology and refers usually to the in-depth study of a particular religious community, usually through field work and sometimes through participant observation. That's the kind of academic work that I'm most comfortable with when I travel to India. But when it comes to comparison, an ethnographic approach, as Jonathan Z. Smith characterizes it, is a travel log. It's a kind of rough and ready sense of similarity and difference. So it's something that everyone practices. All of us do this all the time. And it does have relevance, however, and intellectual content, and it can be something that can really build some very, very complex ways to think about religion. So let's look at what could be called an ethnographic form of comparison. Here's a picture of St. John the 23rd, Pope of the Catholic Church from 1958 to 1963. So notice how he is dressed. He has a white cassock. He has a zucchetta, which is his skull cap. He has a fascia, which is his sash. He also has a pectoral cross, which is gilded with gems inset on it. Though you can't see it now, he does have also a papal ring. So I think if you were to ask most Catholics how they perceive papal garments such as this, they would say it looks otherworldly, celestial, and appropriate for the vicar of Christ. They probably wouldn't mention that this form of dress is historically contingent, that it just didn't fall out of the sky 2,000 years ago. It dates from the 16th century, for example. So let's take a look at another religious leader who I'm sure many of you will recognize, President David O. McKay. And as all of you, I am sure, know, President McKay was responsible for changing the public face of Mormonism. And as far as his white suit was concerned, which is also in the Church History Museum along with Brigham Young's hair, President McKay's biographers, Gregory Prince and William Robert Wright, argue that there were basically two factors responsible for it. One was President McKay's own personal sense of self. You know, he was tall, long gray hair, kind of a stylish guy. And the other was his experience as a missionary in Scotland that gave him an appreciation of European elegance and refinement. But If you look at the Pope and the Prophet comparatively, we can go further than this and begin to probe more deeply Mormon and Catholic conceptions of religious leadership. Both are wearing white, obviously, which obviously reflects notions of purity. White distinguishes them. Popes wear white cassocks, while bishops usually wear black. Publicly, at least as far as I'm concerned, or at least as far as I know, members of the Quorum of the Twelve wear dark suits, but not white suits except for official functions. And of course, now it's considered obligatory for the Pope to wear a white cassock, but President McKay's choice of at least street garb, I don't think, has been replicated by his successors, as far as I know. Well, the Pope is a guardian of the deposit of faith, of tradition. A prophet, on the other hand, is something different. Someone who may be an instrument of God's progressive revelation. So he's modern. He's cutting edge. He's a leader of a restoration. But now he's also a leader of an international church. And so as you see here, this is a Chinese rendering of President McKay. How to convey in Chinese terms that this is a prophet. Just a white suit and tie would not have that kind of significance within a Chinese context. So here he's portrayed as a Mandarin in traditional Chinese dress. And so you can see then how notions of embodiment are absolutely crucial when we talk about religious leadership and are ways in which Catholics and Mormons perhaps can find something to talk about. And so ethnographic comparisons of this type are really, really good conversation starters. I mean, you know, why is the Pope dressed like that? Why does the prophet dress in that way? And they allow us to take specific elements of our experience and use them to create byways for discussion. But the next step is categorizing those specific elements or abstracting from them. And so this is what the encyclopedic mode of comparison does. So if you open an encyclopedia, what you'll see are headings, what might be called topoi or topics. And how these topoi or these topics or how these categories are constructed shapes the way in which a comparison is framed. Okay, so if you're going to list a group of shared characteristics between Mormonism and Catholicism, how you make that list is absolutely crucial. So, for example, if we look comparatively at St. John the 23rd and President McKay, we could most readily talk about types of religious leadership. We could subdivide it and talk about how holiness, power and authority, hierarchy, and charisma of the religious leader are all connected to the way in which the religious leader comports himself. But what I think is most interesting is to move these categories to an even more abstract level. That is to talk in very, very broad themes. In this case, the theme of embodiment strikes me as being most relevant. St. John the 23rd looks like a pope. President McKay looks like a prophet. This is what everyone said during McKay's tenure as president. You know, this is someone who really looks like a prophet. But how and why? I would argue that both the LDS and Catholic traditions both have explicit and implicit notions of what it means to have a body and what that body should express. So I remember the first time I came to the Sunstone Symposium, I wore a suit and tie. I was the only one doing so, and I think I'm still having to learn my lesson. Because, you know, people would joke and say, "Oh, it looks like you're being involved in missionary work and so on and so forth." You know, and I thought, "Well, gee, you know, I'm showing my respect. I'm doing the right thing." You know, and so each tradition has notions of how the body should be presented and protected. Colleen McDaniel again has a wonderful extended discussion of LDS undergarments and priesthood garb. And presents it within the overall context of notions of embodiment. And so we can also talk about Catholic ways of presenting the body, how saints are portrayed, what holy people look like, how individual Catholics present and protect their bodies in particular contexts with things like medals or scapulars or rings, like what I'm wearing on my pinky here. What this kind of comparison, an abstract one, can open up are not only ways to appreciate the similarities and differences between the LDS traditions, but also to extract intellectual content from each tradition. How is holiness expressed through the body? What are the obligations that we have to care for our own bodies and also those of others? What does it mean, finally, to appreciate our embodiment, our materiality, as something that is in the image and likeness of God? Of all the ways to approach Mormonism and Catholicism, I think the encyclopedic is most widely used. There are, of course, apologetics on both sides that use the encyclopedic method in terms of theological categories like baptism or atonement and so on. Well, there have been some good efforts from the LDS side that try to be informative and comparative. Draw your attention, for example, to a recent article by Donald Westerbrook in The Religious Educator a couple years ago in 2012, and also a book by Dr. Alonzo Gaskell. But what I'm outlining here is something that takes us away from theology and focuses more on the embodied, lived experience of what it means to be a Mormon or a Catholic, and what it means to be both and to interact together. The third form of comparison is morphology. And morphology is literally the study of form and structure. And it's probably the form of comparison that might be most familiar to all of you if you've read the works of Mircea Eliade or anything called the Phenomenology of Religion, which used to be very big 30, 40 years ago. So usually what morphology does is trace different forms in which the sacred appears. So you might have a discussion of how each tradition, say Catholicism and Mormonism, defines the sacred and how it's expressed, say through ritual or through certain prohibitions, or clothing, so on and so forth. But you can also take the morphological approach to understand certain symbols or collections of symbols and how they remain the same or different within each tradition. What I'd like to show you here are two clips. One is an LDS depiction, LDS Bible story, which I got online, of the Garden of Gethsemane. The other is a Catholic portrayal of Gethsemane from Mel Gibson's The Passion of the Christ. I then like to reflect on the similarities and differences we see. Okay. Well, in my view, what we have here initially and seemingly are two different kinds of aesthetics. That is, morphologically, the narrative takes on a different structure or composition when you portray the LDS and Catholic portrayals. I have to tell you, from a Catholic perspective, the LDS vision of Jesus here is just too clean cut. There's not enough blood, there's not enough embodied suffering, the kind that you see in the portrayal that Mel Gibson put on the screen. And so I'd be very interested to hear from all of you how you perceive this Catholic portrayal. I'd like to emphasize it's a Catholic portrayal, not the Catholic portrayal, and certainly Mel Gibson and this film are very, very controversial in Catholic circles. And we can talk about why later if you'd like to. But what I think you notice is that there's all this extra scriptural stuff in the Catholic version. The LDS version stays very close to scripture, in verbatim, the Gospels of Mark and Matthew. But here in the Catholic version, you have the devil, you have all this visual drama, not only in the person of Christ, but in the landscape and so forth. Now, I think that for the LDS version, for example, they probably could have rented a smoke machine if they wanted or gotten some dry ice from a biotech firm or something like that. But their goal was to be as close to Scripture as possible. Mel Gibson, on the other hand, was drawing upon the visions of an 18th century Catholic nun, Katharina Emmerich. And in addition to the Bible, he's using her very detailed visions, which are gathered together in a book entitled The Dolorous Passion of Our Lord Jesus Christ. So what this does, then, is lead to different visual aesthetics. But what is really, really interesting, really, really interesting, is that if you look at LDS commentary on Gethsemane more broadly and compare it to Catherine Emmerich's visions and similar theological reflections within the Catholic tradition, the differences between Catholic and Mormon understandings of Gethsemane are much less, and the aesthetics quite similar, than you might initially think. For example, as I'm sure many of you know, James Talmage in his Mass of Jesus the Christ speaks the psychological sufferings of Jesus as he experiences the entirety of human sins, as he asserts his atoning agency. Catherine Emmerich speaks of Jesus going into a grotto, and there he sees the entirety of the sins of humankind. So in both the LDS and the Catholic visions of Gethsemane, we find a real emphasis upon Jesus quite literally taking upon himself humanity sins. And you won't find this in other Christian denominations. But the LDS version is more of an internal psychological struggle, whereas in this particular Catholic version, which lies somewhere between the unofficial and the canonical, the struggle is embodied and to a certain degree externalized. So it's here then, at least I think, that we can get something that we perhaps couldn't get from a straight theological comparison of LDS and Catholic understandings of atonement. Here, through a morphological approach, we can begin to access, albeit partially, the kinds of religious worlds that Mormons and Catholics inhabit and how they intersect and diverge. The foregoing modes of comparison that I've talked about, ethnographic, encyclopedic, and morphological, generally assume that religion is a good thing or a morally neutral thing. But more recently, meaning the last couple of decades, the academic study of religion has undertaken a more critical turn to what could be called an approach that seeks to unmask power relations within religious traditions and reveal how particular doctrines and structures benefit and protect those who already have power and authority. Within academics, such approaches go by the name of genealogy or genealogical because they seek to uncover hidden connections between ideas and power structures in a way not dissimilar to how one might try to uncover familial or genetic relationships that make up a family tree. And in any case, if one is interested in a comparative genealogical approach to religion, Catholicism and Mormonism are ripe for analysis. Both traditions have all male priesthoods. Both have specific practices of inclusion and exclusion. And so if one were to talk to most scholars of religion, you would hear a lot of discussion of how patriarchy plays out both in the Catholic and LDS churches. I'll have to say for myself, while I don't dismiss genealogical approaches, I do find them simplistic. Nonetheless, one thing that Catholics and Mormons do share is how they respond to and negotiate particular claims to authority. Of course, one of the appeals that both the LDS and Catholic traditions have for many is that there are definite claims to authority and truth. This can produce very substantive intellectual approaches to discerning one's own relationship to God and to the surrounding society. But it's also true that some of these very same claims and structures can cause a lot of pain. And so as I stand here tonight, I realize that this is a particularly painful time for many Latter-day Saints given renewed investigations and excommunications in the LDS Church. And it's a pain I think that many Catholics can understand if for the only reason that when you were excluded and ignored by your own brothers and sisters in religious faith, it just hurts, you know, a little more. So in saying this, I'd also like to emphasize that in my view, there are many joys that both Catholics and Mormons share about their membership in their religious traditions that problematize any viewpoint that would claim that everything's about power or oppression. So that leads us then to the final part of my talk, spiritual bridges. And I draw your attention to the second book of Nephi. Behold, hath the Lord commanded any that they should not partake in his goodness? Behold, I say unto you, nay, but all men are privileged, the one like unto the other, and none are forbidden. The visions granted to Nephi are broad, with articulations and foreshadowings of important elements of Mormon doctrine, such as the principle of opposition, progressive revelation, and as we've already discussed, the great apostasy and restoration. Here the book of Nephi touches upon another central facet that runs through the entirety of LDS culture, optimism. Optimism about the ability of all human beings to be saved. From a Catholic perspective, I would say the book of Nephi here is speaking of grace. To be sure, Catholic and Mormon conceptions of grace have different contexts and articulations, but that should not prevent us from seeing the Spirit in each other's lives. At the beginning of this discussion, I drew attention to the Tree of Life, Lehi's Dream, a painting that hangs in the Museum of Church History. This painting is by Stephen Lloyd Neal and was the winner of the first art competition sponsored by the church in 1987. The painting took 4 years to complete, and Dr. Neal is a plastic surgeon and is, as far as I know, still a bishop in Oregon, and he graduated from Brigham Young University in 1977. Writing in Meridian magazine on the 20th anniversary of the painting's completion, Dr. Neal explained its composition. Most significantly, he identified the people in the painting. Okay? So here Lehi is modeled after his father-in-law, and his mother-in-law is the woman holding on to the rod of iron. His Japanese mission partners are portrayed near the Tree of Life, and also, he depicted African-American members of his ward in San Diego, where he was studying at the time he worked on the painting. Dr. Neal's own family, here, is in the foreground. He's dressed in pioneer garb or prairie garb. You might say he's holding out the precious fruit. His wife is also holding the precious fruit, as well as an offering to their eldest daughter, Heidi, who is the girl with the face of radiant whiteness. One thing is for certain, this is quite a self-conscious work of art. So I would disagree strongly with the evaluation of my dear colleague at Holy Cross. I mean, this is someone who thought very, very carefully and deeply about what he was doing. But in order to understand how the work is self-conscious, you have to be in the know. You have to read Meridian magazine, but you have to do also some research. So seen within a Mormon perspective, and I know I'm going out on a limb here, so please correct me fraternally if I'm wrong, the painting itself is a massive work of agency that speaks to the exaltation of the family offered by the acceptance of the restored gospel. It's a powerful, profoundly optimistic painting that almost seems to speak the words of the second book of Nephi, which began this last section of my talk. So, what can a Catholic make of this? And what can I say about the woman who stood beside me, if you remember, with tears welling up in her eyes? An approach that uses the academic study of religion as a touchstone might find a variety of intersections with the Catholic tradition. This is an artifact that is ripe for the kind of analysis that practitioners of the academic study of religion do. So if one wanted to pursue an ethnographic analysis, one might point to the devotional art of Heinrich Hoffmann, a 19th century artist who's popular with both Protestants and Catholics, but also interesting enough among Mormons. I think there was a Heinrich Hoffmann exhibit here not that long ago. The realism or the hyper-realism is as striking in both paintings as is what you could call the sentimentality, except I wouldn't see that as being necessarily bad or meaning that you should devalue the artist's intentions. One could pursue an encyclopedic analysis and focus on the image of the Tree of Life, which does find expression in a number of religious traditions. That image also could be related to Catholic notions of the garden and the afterlife, and also our stewardship of creation. One could see a morphological aspect as well with the tree, particularly how the sacred is expressed through the natural world as a kind of epiphany and experience of the sacred. One could also do a genealogical critique, particularly in how the different races are presented. Also in relation to the blinding whiteness of the girl's skin, the central position of the father of the family, and so forth. While Mormonism certainly has issues with race, gender, and so forth, Catholicism has equally many issues. And artifacts such as these could be interesting ways for Mormons and Catholics to talk about those same issues. So these are places to start, ways to respond to what appears to be alien, different, curious, or unfathomable. They provide a framework that Mormons and Catholics might begin to enter into discussion that circumvents the theological difficulties, with an assumption that God's grace encompasses all things. There has been increasing Mormon and Catholic interaction in the last few years, particularly surrounding Proposition 8 and issues of religious liberty. And so I'll have to confess here, in front of all of you, that I'm not as enthused about these kinds of interactions as I know that some people are. But what I'd like to see more of is Mormons and Catholics joining together to talk about their experiences of God and moving from that to a substantive intellectual engagement that allows us to appreciate each other's religious worlds. So, when I think back to that day in the Church History Museum, I realized there was something I could have done. I could have started a discussion. I could have asked a question. In doing so, I would have had to overcome a great deal of my own discomfort. There would have been personal discomfort about whether I was intruding on someone's religious experience, whether I was inserting myself into a place or experience where I did not belong. There also would have been intellectual discomfort. Where should I begin? What should I ask? But I think if I had started a discussion, if I'd asked a question, it would have been an opportunity to build a bridge. A bridge of friendship that recognizes our shared need for God. A bridge of understanding made real by an openness to the grace of God that manifests itself in all people and in all things. Thank you.
Few minutes for Q&A, so if there's anything burning in you that you want to discuss, and I think I might go first because I'm here and I can grab this microphone.
I don't have to be as close to this one. I am curious, you mentioned this, and I'd like to hear more about this. What are your observations of the scholar of religion as you see Roman Catholic women priests advocating for the opening of priesthood and the growing ordained women movement among LDS women?
Yeah, well, I mean, one thing that that is quite similar is that members of both groups have been excommunicated. They're a group of women who were ordained as priests on a river in Germany, and so it was chosen as a place that would be outside of diocesan jurisdiction, and they were excommunicated. I think certainly within the United States, in the circles that I work in, there is a very, very strong desire for a real reconsideration of an all-male priesthood. Looking at Catholicism worldwide, however, if I were to go to India, go to Africa, go to Latin America, this would not be a very live issue in those Catholic cultures. And so, in one sense, what you see played out, I would argue, in both the LDS traditions and Catholic traditions with regards to the role of women, is kind of, you know, American ways of addressing particular kinds of questions and American understandings of or reflections on gender roles. I can't see within my lifetime the Catholic Church accepting women priests, though I do think Pope Francis has made or will make stronger efforts to include women in more leadership positions. But it's also the case the Catholic Church has changed. I mean, when I read students' writings, they always say, well, the Catholic Church hasn't changed for 2,000 years. It's changed a lot. I do think, however, maybe the LDS tradition provides a much fuller mechanism through progressive revelation than does the Catholic Church for these kinds of changes, though the power structures may not necessarily be amenable to that kind of change.
All right. Other questions? Come on up to the mic.
Okay, are we on? Can you hear me?
Yeah,
cool.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you, Professor. My name is Kurt Mandel, and I was just curious. Obviously, there's a lot of commonalities and similarities between Mormonism and Catholicism. However, one of those commonalities seems to be the exclusive claim to the ultimate legitimate authority of the one true church, or the one completely true church, or mostly true church, or whatever nice terms you want to count that.
95%, yes.
So, my question is, do you see, beyond these intellectual conversations, do you see lay members in mass from both Mormonism and Catholicism ever genuinely being able to build these substantive bridges that you're talking about?
I think they can if they make a shared agreement that they're going to have to, in some ways, put the strongest claims of their religious traditions to the side for a moment. That is, I think it's hard to enter into a dialogue and saying, well, we're exclusively right. On the other hand, it's unfair to ask Mormons and Catholics to abandon their own deepest beliefs. So I like to use the term bracketing out or setting aside for a moment these kinds of truth claims to talk about other issues, which is why I like material culture, because that, or novels or things like that as really great ways to talk about these kinds of religious issues in a more free-flowing way.
Thank you.
Thank you.
First of all, I suppose you've already noticed that Sunstoners really are outliers statistically.
So, I mean, okay, can I just, I don't want to preempt your question, but can I just ask you then, does that mean that you're any less Mormon? Or
no,
just
no.
Mormon in a different way? And
no.
should I say, well, I was with those Sunstone people, you know they're different, but, you know, they're still Mormon?
Well, we of course like to think that we have a little more open mind and are willing to do that kind of bracketing that you're talking about,
mm-hmm.
maybe more than others.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe we are. We like to think we are. We hope we are. Which brings up the question I really had is that I served an LDS mission in France, which is an nominally Catholic country, but not really.
Yeah, nominally, you're right.
On the other hand, I know a lot of people who were missionaries in Latin America and in Africa and other places where the Catholic Church does not look very much like the Catholic Church in France or the Catholic Church in the United States. If we're going to have a dialogue, how do you propose that we strip aside these cultural identity things that have become so much a part of the LDS Church, you know, the green jello thing and funeral potatoes? And, you know,
so is that all true?
How do you decide that? Yeah, it is. We had funeral potatoes for dinner tonight, actually.
Okay.
So how do you strip aside those cultural things and get down to the nub of the discussion?
Well, actually, I personally would look at it in a different way. Since I study global Catholicism, I like the fact that Catholicism is different. And, you know, as you say quite rightly, Catholicism is practiced in Africa is different than it is practiced in Europe. And I'd be interested to hear from people when you talk to Africans, for example, who are LDS, or Latin Americans who are LDS, I mean, what their experiences are. But what I like about cultural diversity is that it destabilizes people. I mean, and it also kind of loosens in some ways our conventional assumptions about who we are. So in one sense, I wouldn't be in favor of kind of bracketing out those kind of cultural differences. I would in some ways be in favor of highlighting them, you know, as a way of loosening things up in a way to talk about different forms that religions can take. That's sort of my own view on that. Very good point. Thank you.
I know you didn't talk about the evolutionary process, but looking at the history of both churches, and people say, well, the Catholic Church dealt with this a long time ago, or they've had time to smooth it over. We don't know all of the warts and issues in the Catholic Church because they happened a long time ago. Mm-hmm. Is there anything that, do you see a similarity in the way that the two organizations are proceeding from their beginning forward? And if so, are there any hints that you might give the Mormons to avoid?
It would be presumptuous of me. I mean, as a Catholic, I'm very painfully aware of many mistakes the Catholic Church continues to make. But one of the things I think that when I as a Catholic look at the LDS tradition, you know, I see that it has a hierarchy, okay, and it has a leader who is a prophet. And what I think is really a pressing question for the LDS Church is, when is the prophet speaking as a prophet? You know, I mean, you know, what kind of authority does his teachings have. I mean, there are certain times when he claims a particular revelation from God and so forth, but there are a variety of other teachings. Like, for example, at Holy Cross, my students, I have to explain to them that papal infallibility is something very specific. It doesn't mean that the way in which the Pope brushes his teeth is the way in which everyone should brush his teeth or something like that. But I think, you know, articulating more clearly in some ways doctrinal issues and creating a space for open debate. I think what I continually see in the Catholic tradition is this real sense that anything new is going to challenge this edifice of faith. And so the initial reaction to anything new is to be very, very suspicious. And I think you know, the Catholic Church has been very, very behind in dealing with serious issues within his own church, and also serious social issues, because it is very afraid of the new. But it, you know, and so I'd like to ask all of you. I mean, in some ways, the LDS tradition is something new. I mean, it's considered to be open, you know, cutting edge. On the other hand, you know, it's very, you know, very bound in particular authoritarian or constructs of authority. So there's an interesting tension there in the LDS tradition that Catholics look at with interest.
We've been learning to follow the Catholic Church very nicely in that way.
Yes. Okay.
for newbies, have we got patriarchy down?
I wanted to make a comment about church art. Mm-hmm. I hope that's not an oxymoron. I greatly admired the work of Mel Gibson with The Passion of the Christ.
Oh, really?
Which he did as an artist and with full courage exploring his concept. I thought pretty much as far as it could go. The problem with the movies that are sponsored by the church itself is as a general population, we're not really taught to be sophisticated in the way we appreciate art or looking for someone confronting himself. And there's a lot of commercial support for people who only go partway and just present it in a very narrative way that mm-hmm. doesn't cause the viewer to have to confront himself. Mm-hmm. Like when I was watching the two clips, I didn't have any real emotional reaction to the LDS clip, but as soon as you started the Passion of the Christ, I start to feel it. So anyway, you asked for a response. I think it's someone, a theater teacher who does a really good job around here, was talking about a very commercially successful theater here in Salt Lake, and she said they're like McDonald's. They've figured out their audience, and they're just going to keep giving them the same thing.
Thank you.
We appreciate your coming. I'm a mainstream Mormon, not an outlier. I had a conversation this week with my doctor, young woman, Roman Catholic, and she expressed to me, as we had become a little bit better acquainted over time, that she was disappointed the way things have changed at Judge Memorial High School, a local Catholic high school. Mm. When she was there, there were at least a few Catholic priests whom she admired and respected enormously. And now there are none, she said.
Right.
She also indicated that she is sending her children to a Catholic school near our home, and that the situation there is similar. Since you brought up the subject of the family in this shot, what do you see as the prospects of the church changing? We know it's not dogma, we know it's policy, but it's very old and very respected policy, in changing or adjusting that program so that this one doctor, at least, if not many others, might send their children to Catholic schools where there are priests, they'll marry, and they will have the satisfaction and the joy, as she expressed to me, of raising her children in a Catholic school.
Right. Well, there are a couple issues. Pope Francis recently did say, I think this was like 2 weeks ago, that he was going to address the celibacy issue, which he sees as, or which a lot of people see as one reason why the Roman Catholic Church is losing vocations. There are other rites within the Catholic Church, particularly Eastern rites, where priests can marry. However, now this is going to sound really, really weird, okay, but I'll tell you this. According to Catholic canon law, the priests who marry in these different rites that are still Catholic have to practice what is called continence. Okay, so that is, they can be married, but, you know, they're sort of living together as brother and sister, shall we say. So a lot of conservative Catholic theologians say, well, you can't change this whole thing right now because there are all these other kind of laws that would have to be changed. I do think it depends on I think the pontificate of Pope Francis and how that plays out, how long it will be. There's been this great upsurge and upswell of love and affection for him, and he has indicated that he is open to more women in leadership roles in the church and often and re-examining celibacy. But also within the Catholic Church, there's a real backlash building against Pope Francis right now. And so we'll have to see how it plays out. But I will say the next 5 years, there might be some changes coming in that score. We'll have to see.
Hi, thanks for coming. My comment question is about the Book of Mormon reference, the great and abominable church.
Right.
You referenced earlier. I have very strong childhood memories of the 1970s when ranking Mormon leaders would define that clearly as being a Catholic church.
Right.
And then throughout the 1980s, 1990s, I didn't hear it talked about much at all. And then in the early 2000s, a new definition emerged that the great and abominable was much more general. It was a reference to consumerism and and unabashed buying and commerce and advertising not properly representing products. And this
really?
Kind of more organic definition.
Interesting.
At least that's the definition that surrounds me in my community today. To draw a question from this, I like to think that when my church is more organic, when it can change its definitions, I like to see that as a good thing.
Yeah.
I know there's a lot of debate that can come from that, and perhaps because the LDS Church is roughly 1% in population to world Catholics, it perhaps it's more like a small boat moving in the water when Catholicism is much large, like an ocean sea vessel.
Yeah.
Do you see, to draw a question from this now, do you see any kind of changes in your church that where there's pushback, perhaps much like the ordained women concept that was talked about earlier, or any other topics where the church at large is starting to listen to that influence and shift?
Well, I think Pope Francis has really shifted the terms of debate. I think one of the things, and I mentioned this a little in my talk, and you're all familiar with this, one of the things that's happened, certainly within Catholicism, is this approach to doing combat with what is perceived to be the secular culture. And there has developed, I think, almost a sectarian Catholic identity, this notion that, you know, the church really should withdraw, it should set its boundaries very, very starkly, it should oppose gay marriage and so on and so forth. And on certain of those issues, it's allied itself with the LDS Church. With Pope Francis, there has been a quite radical change to openness to engagement with the surrounding culture. A less of a tone that emphasizes condemnation, but one that emphasizes reconciliation and forgiveness. And where the pushback is coming is that some people think that there are intellectual issues, theological issues associated with this, that particularly issues that are very important, like abortion, are going to be swept aside. Secondly, there are powerful constituencies within the Catholic Church who have benefited very much from this emphasis upon sexuality as opposed to social justice. And what Francis is talking about is is what they call a seamless garment, where Catholic teachings about sexuality and social justice are joined. And so everyone's being challenged. Some people are feeling as though the church that they grew up in that had these hard and fast boundaries is suddenly changing under their feet. So we'll see how much it actually does change. I think Pope Francis may not be as much of a radical as people think he is, but we will see.
I think that most I'm ascribing my feelings to most people, and I don't think that's true, but I just really admire Pope Francis and what he's has said and what he is doing. You mentioned that there is a great deal of pushback from certain elements in the Catholic Church with regard to Pope Francis' views.
Yeah.
I'm assuming that pushback would come from members of the Catholic priesthood and hierarchy.
Yes.
Perhaps more than from the rank and file Catholic, although maybe that's too general.
Well, there are very strong constituencies in the Catholic Church who really felt as though the Catholic teachings on sexuality were what distinguished Catholics, you know, within this culture, and that they represented an important counter-witness against secularism and a kind of witness toward life. And so many of those people who, you know, some of whom are actually politically liberal in some ways, are wondering now what all the fuss was about then, if Pope Francis is going to say things like, who am I to judge when it comes to, gay and lesbian brothers and sisters. But I think there is this sense of how the context for how we talk about what it is to be Catholic is changing. And for me, it's a real breath of fresh air. I mean, I'm really very excited.
My perception is that when it comes to the president of the Mormon Church, any pushback would not come from stake presidents and bishops in any public way. Whereas there may be elements of the Catholic priesthood that really would push back and feel very open about pushing back.
Yeah.
That phenomenon doesn't seem to be part of the Mormon experience at this point. The notion of following the prophet is very, very strong, and I think that any pushback would tend to come from people having private conversations and not being very public about that pushback. From among the rank and file, of course, since we had a lay priesthood, then there are some bishops and stake presidents who, in private conversation, would express questions about what some of the church leaders say, and I have a feeling, although I don't know that. I don't know how true this is. I have a feeling that there are probably men in the hierarchy of the Mormon Church who privately have feelings that they would never express publicly because of the necessity of the perception of total unity among the church leadership. And I think that the Catholic Church has been around so much longer than we have.
Well, Pope Benedict did say that was not very fond of public criticism because he said it gave ammunition to enemies of the Church. So sometimes there can be this bunker mentality among Catholics as well, particularly in American society where Catholics have been considered to be weird and outliers themselves. That puts a real emphasis upon public face of unity, but that doesn't hold out for very long, as you say. Yeah.
I heard a Catholic priest one time describe
a sort of notion of, that Catholicism has a notion of a priesthood of believers. And I know in Mormonism does too.
Wrong!
The idea of God's power being a sort of a democratization of God's power. Unfortunately, right now it's only for half the adult membership.
Right.
But I mean, I think it's a powerful and a strength of Mormonism that somehow you have this notion of God's power being disseminated to all.
Yes.
You know, eventually all, hopefully. But I heard a priest speak at Claremont, and he's sort of another idea. I mean, various types of priesthood in the Catholic Church, and one of them was this notion of a communal priesthood. And do you know what he's talking about?
Well,
I'm interested in that.
I mean, there in the wake of the Second Vatican Council, there are ways in which the office of the priest was rethought to include acting in concert with the laity. But I think there's been a big move, at least before Pope Francis under Benedict and John Paul II, to move back from that. For example, I was just in Sri Lanka for 4 months running a study abroad program, and I did research on Catholic faith healing. And it used to be this wild environment where you'd have lay people casting out demons and getting prophecies and so on and so forth, part of what's called the Catholic Charismatic Movement, which some of you might be familiar with. It's very much like draws something, a lot of things from Pentecostal religiosity. That's all been banned now. It's only priests who can do that kind of stuff. So I think there was, in certain parts of Catholicism, a kind of effort to, what was perceived to be an effort to encroach upon the authority of the priest, and that has, and that under John Paul II and Benedict XVI was counteracted. But under Francis, perhaps some of those ideas might resurface. But you know, it'd be hard. Under canon law, for example, in certain kinds of emergencies, like in baptism, for example, as a layperson, you can exercise a kind of sacramental authority. But apart from that, I think priesthood is being taken in a kind of different non-sacramental way, probably, in that. Interesting.
I like to read a lot of Raymond Brown.
Mm.
And in one...
Louder?
Just speak closer.
Just speak closer? Okay. I like to read a lot of Raymond Brown, and my recollection is in one of his books he talked about how the real enemy to the church, he was referring to the Catholic Church, the real enemy to the church is not the intellectuals of the church, but the conservatives of the church. Which sort of goes along with something we were just talking about. I wonder if you would comment on that as it pertains to Mormonism as well as Catholicism.
Okay. Well, I would say this. One of the things that's really struck me being in a Catholic school is how much Catholics fight, and that there's a real division, particularly in Catholic higher education, between quote-unquote liberals and quote-unquote conservatives. And I'm not really fond of those distinctions because I think they're divisive. I know liberals, you know, who are very, very eager to shut out conservative voices, just as conservatives sometimes can be very eager to shut out liberal voices. And so if there's anything perhaps the LDS tradition could learn from Catholicism is to how not to manage these kinds of disagreements or to dispense with these kinds of labels. Because I think when you look at what liberal means in a conventional American sense or what conservative means in a conventional American sense, it doesn't really apply to the, you know, breadth and diversity of Catholic belief. Even though, and I'm going out on a limb here, Mormonism is taken to be, in some ways, the quintessentially American religion, it doesn't necessarily seem to me that being Mormon has to mean that you have conservative politics in the conventional American sense. That there are a lot of teachings about economics and so forth within the LDS tradition, you know, that are very, very different from what would be considered standard orthodoxy within American conservatism. So I think one thing in both traditions is you have to getting beyond labeling the other person, I think, is really, really important.
It's late. I'll talk fast. I commend you for being a spokesman for a billion people.
Someone has to do it.
Yeah.
I was a chaplain just after Vatican II. And I saw the priests in the Air Force wrestle with the implications of Vatican II for what they called the ministry. It was a wrenching experience because they were good men.
Louder.
Speak up.
They were good men and they worked very hard. Now it's happening in our group. You're 2,000 years old, we're 200.
Yeah.
You're a billion. We're proud of having crested two digits. And depending on who you talk to, we're somewhere between 8 and 15, depending on who counts. But there's one big difference, and I'd like to point of view on this. The Gutenberg Press created a major dilemma for the controlling authority of Europe that had been in place for a millennium. The Internet has created a major dilemma for both you folks,
yes,
and us. Is it a leveler that will speed change in an unexpected way, and to what extent?
I think that's a really excellent question and something that demands a lot of thought. I'll just say this. I blog, and basically no one reads my blogs, which you know, is understandable. But I do know bishops do take into consideration other blogs, and especially when it comes to the sexual abuse scandal, the driving force behind holding bishops and individual priests into account has been the internet, has been the media. So I think, in one sense, it has been a leveler. At least it's a kind of the internet represents a kind of forum that authorities within both traditions have to engage in a way that challenges their claims to authority. And so I think it being a leveler is a really important observation. How it plays out, we'll have to see. But when the Pope started tweeting, you know, I knew something pretty big was going on. So.
All right. One more round of applause for our speaker tonight.